You're listening to the CyberWire Network, powered by N2K.
Hey, everybody. Today, I want to highlight a name that all of us know well, and that is our sponsor, Splunk. You need to keep operations humming around the clock, but potential disruptions are everywhere. Splunk helps you predict problems and find and fix issues fast so you can reduce risk and ditch downtime. The world's largest enterprises rely on Splunk's unified security and observability platform to become more efficient, resilient, and innovative. With Splunk, you can react quickly, evolve faster, and be ready for anything. Stay ahead of disruptions. Learn more at splunk.com/resilience. And we thank Splunk for sponsoring our show. In the complex world of enterprise identity, securing legacy web apps at scale can be daunting. Strata Identity makes it simple. With Strata, you can effortlessly integrate non-standard apps with any identity service, like MFA or SSO, with zero coding and zero hassle. Designed by identity architects for identity architects, Strata works with every vendor, standard, and app architecture. This means your apps can now speak modern protocols and integrate seamlessly with your chosen identity services. From securing on-prem web apps to migrating away from outdated identity providers or consolidating them, Strata helps you keep your complex access policies as you modernize your identity infrastructure and get rid of technical debt. Join leading organizations like 3M, Dallas County, and CIBC in securing your apps with Strata. Visit strata.io/cyberwire, share your identity security priorities, and receive a complimentary pair of AirPods Pro. Offer valid for organizations with over 5,000 employees. Connect today at strata.io/cyberwire.
Ukraine warns that Russia is preparing a coordinated attack against Ukrainian financial and energy infrastructure. China appears to be stepping up surveillance of the Tibetan diaspora. Cisco's Talos unit has a free decryptor for Thanatos ransomware. Facebook's self-audit of data usage proves both more difficult and more skeleton-rattling than hoped. Norwegian consumer watchdogs find that Facebook and Google nudge users away from privacy. And an altcoin sting against drug dealers. From the CyberWire studios at Data Tribe, I'm Dave Bittner with your CyberWire summary for Thursday, June 28, 2018. The head of Ukraine's National Cyber Police has warned that Russian operators are staging malware in Ukrainian enterprises, presumably for a coordinated campaign at some later date. Ukrainian authorities have told Reuters and others that they've detected evidence that battle space preparation is in progress against financial institutions and energy infrastructure. The operation, as it's understood so far, has proceeded in the following familiar stages. First, compromise of legitimate Ukrainian government email accounts. Second, phishing campaigns mounted against infrastructure targets using those compromised accounts. Third, installation of malicious payloads carried by the emails. The malware is believed to have established backdoors in banking and energy enterprises, where it will presumably be held in reserve until the attackers decide to execute. The threat, should it materialize, is unlikely to be confined to Ukraine. NotPetya began with attacks on Ukrainian targets in June of last year and quickly spread worldwide. A number of Western companies were hit hard. FedEx, affected to a considerable extent through a recently acquired European subsidiary, recently pegged the costs of NotPetya at roughly $400 million. Today is Ukraine's Constitution Day, often mentioned as attractive to attackers wishing to draw maximal attention to their political point. Nothing, however, has been reported so far today. August 24th, the country's Independence Day, is another date mentioned for potential attack timing. Russian authorities have issued routine denials of involvement in cyber attacks on Ukrainian targets. To be sure, the Ukrainian government is disposed for many reasons to think the worst of Russia and her intentions, but the Ukrainian government is by no means alone in this respect. Much of the rest of the world regards Ukraine as a kind of proving ground for Russian cyber attack tools. The Russian record of hitting portions of the Ukrainian power grid to induce electrical outages is particularly worrisome, especially given the interest Russian operators have shown in other countries' power grids. So, as we said, Moscow says they didn't do nothing, and Ukraine says, well, you're about to. If nothing pops today, put a circle on your calendar around August 24th. But when you do so, remember that public holidays are nothing more than convenient indicators. More to the point, keep an eye out for phishing. Open source software is a valuable resource for software developers and security professionals, and the recent purchase of GitHub by Microsoft raised a few eyebrows and brought attention to the open source community. Jaime Blasco is chief scientist at Alien Vault, and he offers his perspective on open source software for security.
I think it's a double-edged sword, right? I mean, on one hand, you need to be careful with, you know, which tools you're using, especially if they are open source, and whether or not those tools are properly, you know, secure, audited, and, you know, people are putting enough resources into securing and auditing the source code. When it comes to, you know, the most popular open source projects, that's usually not an issue. And actually, it's an advantage, you know, that the source code is publicly available because you have all these developers, all these security researchers looking at the code and, you know, submitting bugs and improvements whenever they find them.
Now, when it comes to using open source tools, do you find, are there some misperceptions out there? Do some people resist using them, maybe for the wrong reasons?
I think it used to be an issue. I don't see this being an issue anymore. And I think, you know, like last week or a couple of weeks ago when Microsoft bought GitHub, I think that was the confirmation that, you know, open source is the future. And we are seeing these, you know, companies such as Microsoft, and 10, 15 years ago, it was unbelievable that they will contribute to open source communities. They're actually one of the biggest contributors right now to some of the biggest open source projects out there. So I think people are not as scared of these tools anymore. They have become an instrumental part of any organization nowadays.
Can you describe to us, I mean, the security advantages? You touched on it earlier about having so many eyes on the code. Can you describe to us, so why? What's the advantage there?
So, yeah, besides having many people being able to audit and find vulnerabilities in those tools, the other advantage is also how fast, you know, patches can be created and released compared to some traditional, you know, enterprise vendors. Like, sometimes you will have to wait weeks or months until your vendor will make patches available. With open source tools, if there is a high critical vulnerability, many times you have many people creating patches for those vulnerabilities, even before the official patch is available. So you have an option to, you know, make that piece of software more secure even before, you know, you can use the official packaging system or whatever method to patch your systems you are using. I think cybersecurity is actually one of the biggest examples in terms of using open source tools. Many times enterprises, they have this dilemma where, you know, it's buy versus build. And, you know, I think open source is helping sometimes in terms of, you know, filling those gaps where you don't have to spend millions of dollars anymore in one specific tool, but you can go to the open source community and find something that can satisfy your needs. And I think, you know, in cybersecurity, it has been one of the first industries to adopt like open source tools in a broader context. Like, you know, I remember 10 years ago, you will have projects such as Snort and OSIM and Suricata, OpenBus, even Nisus before it became proprietary. But, you know, there were many, many tools that people were actively using on an enterprise context.
So what are your recommendations for people who want to start using open source tools, want to integrate them into how they approach security?
I would recommend, you know, go talk to your peers and, you know, talk to other companies that are in a similar situation that maybe they have already, you know, implemented some of these tools. Now there's there are forums, even GitHub, or you know, Slack channels where you can go and talk to other users and try to get, you know, a perspective of, you know, how difficult the implementation is gonna be and if there is any, you know, tricks and things you can use before you decide to implement that in terms or even replace some of the enterprise tools that you might have.
That's Jaime Blasco from Alien Vault. Cyber espionage campaigns, apparently staged by and from China, have been targeting Tibetans resident in India. The campaign seems connected with long-standing Chinese domestic surveillance of ethnic populations whose loyalty and adherence to Beijing have been suspect. Bravo Talos, Cisco's research unit, has released a free decryptor for Thanatos ransomware. Thanatos gained itself a degree of notice by its acceptance of ransom payments in a range of cryptocurrencies, and not just in the extortionist's favorite, Bitcoin. The crooks will take payment in Bitcoin Cash, Zcash, Ethereum, and a few others as well. To add insult to injury, the Thanatos masters have shown themselves to be either incapable of, or more probably just not interested in, actually decrypting their victims' files upon payment of ransom. But Cisco's Talos group has exploited what they call weaknesses in the design of the file encryption methodology to build their own decryptor, which they say can recover a decryption key in 14 minutes or less. The Norwegian Consumer Council, sounding a bit like a Freakonomics type interested in getting the right kind of nudges out there, complain that Facebook, and for that matter Google, are nudging toward all the wrong places, privacy-wise. The NCC says their services exhibit dark patterns, default anti-privacy settings, confusing layouts, the illusion of choice, and various design choices that offer positioning, visual cues, and so forth, tending to push people into more self-revelation than is probably good for them. As they put it in their study, quote, Facebook and Google have privacy-intrusive defaults, where users who want the privacy-friendly option have to go through a significantly longer process. They even obscure some of these settings so that the user cannot know that the more privacy-intrusive option was pre-selected. End quote. So the moral for users would appear to be the usual one. Take the trouble to be an informed consumer, especially when you're consuming a free service offered by a company that realizes a significant fraction of its revenue from marketing. Finally, a multi-agency law enforcement operation in the U.S. has taken down a number of alleged dark web contraband dealers, for the most part drug traffickers. The action involved the Department of Justice, Homeland Security Investigations, the U.S. Secret Service, the U.S. Postal Inspection Service, and the Drug Enforcement Administration. Authorities are tight-lipped about details, but apparently government agents posed as cryptocurrency money launderers to roll up the suspects. Turning cryptocurrencies into more conventional and more easily negotiable government fiat money is a bottleneck for dark web black marketeers. Agents of Immigration and Customs Enforcement's Homeland Security Investigations posed in the dark web as brokers willing and able to do just that, and many drug dealers were ensnared. If you're trying to launder money or convert altcoins to euros, dollars, shekels, or pazuzas, well, think twice. Those helpful bankers may not be what they appear to be. It's a sad day when you can't trust the people you meet through a Tor node. And I'm pleased to welcome to the show Mike Benjamin. He's the Senior Director of Threat Research at CenturyLink. Mike, welcome to the show. You know, I have certainly heard of malware, and I've certainly heard of spam. But you brought something to my attention called mal spam. Is this the best of both worlds? Is this the worst of both worlds? Fill us in. What are we talking about here?
Well, I'd say it's the best and the worst, depending on how you look at it. So, you know, mal spam is not a new topic or concept, but we have found as we've been working on the topic lately that when we say we're working on spam to the broader security community, we actually get a lot of folks just assuming we're filtering pharmaceutical ads or dating ads. And what we're really trying to look at is the malicious email people are getting. And so we call, you know, describe it as mal spam. And we would describe it ultimately as email you're going to get that aims to do something malicious. Now, in some cases, dating spam is mal spam because ultimately they want to steal your credit card number at the end of it. And in other cases, pump and dump scams are pumped through these things with, again, trying to ultimately steal money from people. But at its core, we're looking for the malware delivery. And so mail spam is one of the primary vehicles of infection these days. We saw a couple of years ago the exploit kit being popular with criminal actors. And there were enough browser exploits, enough Java bugs, enough Flash bugs, that was a great delivery mechanism for them. They could get you to click on a URL. They could inject malice into advertising and ultimately infect people through that method. Fast forward a few years, a lot of browsers have cleaned up their problems. A lot of people have patched. There's less volume of bugs coming out. And we put ourselves back into the position where opening a file in an email is a really effective way to infect someone. And so the old tried and true zip file, the file that is not what it claims to be a text file, it's really an executable, things like that are, of course, popular. But we've also seen the macro still be a popular way to infect people. So an Office document with macros that drop some sort of lightweight dropper into the operating system and then download the final payload. And so that dropper is relatively light and small. It's not a full binary executable. And then whatever it is that their final outcome that they're looking to achieve is downloaded into the machine.
Now, in terms of the distribution of these things and tracking these botnets, what are you seeing?
The criminal space around mail spam is reasonably sophisticated. If you think back to the spam problems that arose in the late 90s and then became really rampant in the early 2000s, they were forced to evolve. And so the security world, the internet world for that matter, did a relatively good job hunting down and shutting down spammers in that era. People were successfully prosecuted in courts. Laws were passed, and those are things that helped the world mature around how to deal with spam. And so, as you might expect, the successful criminal actors that remain, they've evolved since then. And so you see sort of a marketplace around what they're doing. The folks who are running the spam botnets are very rarely, at least at any size and scale, the folks who are actually trying to infect you. They are being hired by the people who are trying to infect you. And the folks who are after bank account information or installing crypto miners, they're paying the botnet operators for successful installs or volume of delivery or whatever the mechanism is. So it's very interesting to watch. And as such, what you see from the botnets is a similar level of sophistication. They're not a single command and control in a single place that's easy to remove and take down. They've evolved. They've seen law enforcement take their botnets in the past. And so now, of course, they evolved to the domain generation algorithm, or DGA, where an algorithm tells it what the next DNS host name to resolve is. That's one of the more simple items that they've implemented. But there's a lot of redundancy, a lot of levels to the command and control. In many cases, we see peer-to-peer being used in conjunction with it. And in almost all cases, the larger and more successful mail spam botnets are in a position where they're using three or four of these types of techniques in order to stay up and avoid being broken by whether it be law enforcement or the security community.
All right. Mike Benjamin, thanks for joining us.
Don't struggle to align your organization's cybersecurity with business risk. Get the only solution that goes beyond reacting to threats with vulnerability and risk monitoring. You need the next evolution of MDR, and only Critical Start delivers it. Critical Start doesn't just monitor and respond to threats. They put you in control by detecting suspicious activities, quickly responding to contain threats, and identifying your most critical assets and protecting them against vulnerabilities and exposures. With continuous visibility, expert guidance, and measurable risk reduction, Critical Start has redefined what it means to manage cyber risk. Demonstrate provable security maturity to your leadership while positioning your program to achieve the greatest risk reduction per dollar spent. Stop fearing risk and start managing it with Critical Start. Visit CriticalStart.com and request a demo today. That's CriticalStart.com. And that's the CyberWire.
For links to all of today's stories, check out our daily briefing at thecyberwire.com. And for professionals and cybersecurity leaders who want to stay abreast of this rapidly evolving field, sign up for CyberWire Pro. It'll save you time and keep you informed. Listen for us on your Alexa smart speaker, too. The CyberWire podcast is proudly produced in Maryland out of the startup studios of Data Tribe, where they're co-building the next generation of cybersecurity teams and technologies. Our amazing CyberWire team is Elliot Peltzman, Puru Prakash, Stefan Vaziri, Kelsey Bond, Tim Nodar, Joe Kerrigan, Carol Terrio, Ben Yellen, Nick Vilecki, Gina Johnson, Bennett Moe, Chris Russell, John Petrick, Jennifer Iben, Rick Howard, Peter Kilpie, and I'm Dave Bittner. Thanks for listening. We'll see you back here tomorrow. And now a word from our sponsor, SpyCloud, the leader in operationalizing cybercrime analytics. Traditional threat intelligence is a thing of the past. Cyber criminals are stealing vast amounts of credentials, session cookies, and financial data every day, and it's hard to keep up. SpyCloud is the trusted partner businesses turn to fully understand their darknet exposure risk and neutralize threats before it's too late. SpyCloud alerts your organization as soon as an employee or customer's data appears on the dark net, so you can act faster than bad actors to prevent cyber attacks like ransomware, session hijacking, account takeover, and online fraud. With insights from the industry's largest repository of recaptured data, protect the digital identities and systems most important to your business. Get your free corporate darknet exposure report at spycloud.com/cyberwire and see what information criminals have in their hands today. That's spycloud.com/cyberwire.